10, maybe 11 after 8. And if anyone has cell phones on, I'd ask you to turn them off or turn them down anyway. And let the record reflect this morning that Representative Seaton, Representative Moses, and myself, Wilson, are here this morning. As Vice Chair, I'll be presiding over today's meeting because Representative Wyrock is on his way to Washington, D.C. So we will continue on with our tax issue overview by the Department of Revenue. And we have with us this morning several people either online or here in the room. And so what I'll do is I will introduce Tom Butan, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And Tom, I'll let you introduce the rest of them.
You bet. Thank you. Again, Tom Butan, Department of Revenue. Commissioner Bill Corbus wanted to be here, but he was called away to some meetings in Anchorage today, unfortunately. Of course, he's been at the prior House Ways and Means Committee meetings. With us today, we have Dan Dickinson, Tax Division Director, Chuck Hollermont, Operations Manager of the Tax Division, Brett Freed, who's an economist with the Tax Division, and Tim Cottingen, who's an audit manager. On the phone, we have Mark Graber, who's an audit manager, and Joanna Bales, who's also an audit manager. When we get going, Dan Dickinson will talk about the non-oil tax structure, but I'm sure he can answer any questions that might be remaining also about oil taxes. Mark Graber, again, who's in Anchorage, will talk about non-oil corporate income taxes. And Joanna Bales will talk about excise taxes. Brett Freed will cover mining, timber, tourism, and other areas. And then Tim Cottingen will talk about fisheries taxes. Just a quick recap of what we've where we've been here in this Department of Revenue overview that we've had with House Ways and Means. We talked about the financial condition of state government, cash flow, reserves, liquidity, and credit ratings. We spent a considerable amount of time talking about the revenue forecast and described oil taxes, including, of course, the ELF. Commissioner Corbus said that the short-term financial condition is good and the very long term is good, but the period in between could be bad. In talking about solutions to that, he talked about POMV as the fiscal gap solution that took most of our energy and time. Governor Murkowski, of course, put that solution on the table, as we all know, and we spent a lot of time on that, and there was a special session. My recollection is that POMV guaranteed and protected the dividend, and as a solution, therefore, it's still something to take a look at. In the very, very long term, Alaska's fiscal gap will be solved by resource revenues. Revenues from the gas line and other resource development will come online to be the basis of the economy. With that, I'll ask Dan Dickinson to talk about non-oil tax structure, and then the other people can come up in turn. And given the number of chairs, I'll go sit back there. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom. Madam Chairman, committee members of the committee, good morning. I would like to talk very briefly about the, not necessarily the structure, but just an overview of the non-oil and gas taxes, and then have each of the folks who actually deal with them day to day come and give a more in-depth picture. If I could, I'd like to hold the questions on the ELF till the end. Sometimes those tend to get drawn out, and I'd rather make sure we can cover the things we're going to cover this morning, first of all. I think the best place to start, and I hope folks all have a copy of our operations report, the best place to start is to simply go to page 1. And there's just two things there that I'll draw folks' attention to. The top is a pie chart, and it basically shows the general revenue money. And again, I want to make sure that this is not general revenue as it's used when folks are writing the budget, which is about a $2.4 billion figure. But this is general funds as used by the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. There were $4.6 billion in fiscal year 2004, and of that, we've broken it down into four pieces. The largest piece, I think, as many folks are aware, is federal money, $1.9 billion. The next largest piece are the taxes administered by the Tax Division at about $1.2 billion. The next largest piece are royalties administered by Department of Natural Resources. That's $1.1 billion. And then there's sort of everything else at $400 million. As we focus in on the $1.2 billion of taxes administered by the Tax Division, about $1 billion of those are oil and gas taxes. And what we're going to focus on is the remainder. It rounds to around $200 million while we're talking at this level. It's something just underneath that. And what are those taxes? And for that, you can go down to the bottom half of that page. We've broken them down into about six different pieces. The first one, like I say, we're not going to talk about today. We've talked about prior, which is the oil and gas taxes. The next large group is the excise taxes. Joanna Bales will be on the phone from Anchorage talking about those. There's been a lot of movement in those recently. Two new excise taxes added in the last several years on tires and rental vehicles. A lot of change has been going on in the area of the tobacco tax. We've added the stamp as an enforcement tool. Last summer in a special session, of course, the tobacco tax was raised from $1 a pack to $1.60. The next category on this page is other taxes, and we're not really going to focus on those. If folks have questions, we can answer. There are, you know, the famous miscellaneous or other taxes. The next one on the list is the corporate income taxes, non-oil and gas. They're in the same structure as corporate oil and gas taxes, but there are special rules for the oil and gas corporations. Mark Graber, who's the audit manager for the income tax program, is also on the phone, and he'll be talking about those. The final tax type are the fisheries taxes. Tim Cottingham, who looks after that program for us, is here with us, and he'll be speaking about those taxes. I'll just quickly, to give an overview of our division, the other three things we do, which are not specifically tax related, of course, are we administer charitable gaming, and I'm sure many of you have dealt with us in that context in other areas. We issue the salmon pricing report three times a year to try to bring some transparency to some of the markets. And finally, I know you all are familiar with our revenue sources reporting. So that's what we do, and if I could, I'd like to now turn it over to the Mark Graber and the rest of the team that's here, who are going to talk about the specific tax types, unless there's any questions.
Doesn't look like it.
Thank you. Is Mark on the phone?
Yes. Good morning. This is Mark Graber in Anchorage. As Dan said, I'm the audit manager for the corporate income tax program. Dan, I guess folks have the handouts we prepared.
Just hold them up or something. What do they look like?
They do.
Sure?
This page here.
This one. Okay.
Correct.
Yes, we do. We sure do.
Great. Thanks.
Welcome this morning, and go ahead, and we'll listen and throw in a question once in a while.
Great. That's great. On the outline there, I've listed the statute and regulations. It's under 4320.073, and the regulations are 15AC20. In fiscal 04, the division collected $39.5 million. That's detailed on page 13 of the annual report in table 2. As far as our taxpayers go, generally we're talking about large multi-state corporations. Want to turn to the annual report on page 29, table 5, sort of a breakdown of the taxpayers sort of stratified by the amount of tax they pay. The basic features of the tax, sorry to get a little technical here, but it's water's edge combination and apportionment of federal taxable income. What that means is an apportionment means that we determine the taxable income by formula as opposed to separate accounting of the income and expenses within Alaska. Combination means that we apply that formula to the total taxable income of a combined group of corporations, not just the corporate affiliate that does business in Alaska. so that if you were to envision a Fortune 500 company that's made up of hundreds of subsidiaries, we would apply our formula to the total group income, not just the subsidiary that does business in Alaska. Now, water's edge, when I use the term water's edge, that means that we only include the income and factors of the affiliates that do business in the U.S. as opposed to the worldwide combination and apportionment that we use for the oil and gas companies. Next on the outline, I give you sort of the basic formula of the tax.
Just a second, Mark. Representative Seaton has a question for you.
Thanks, Mark. Would you explain water's edge in a little more detail?
Sure. In 1991, the legislature passed what we kind of refer to as the water's edge legislation. Prior to that, we combined and did our calculation on the worldwide group of corporations, which means that you would take foreign subsidiaries of the group and include them in the formula. Under water's edge, we exclude foreign corporations so that basically you only include corporations that do business in the United States.
Follow up.
So your water's edge doesn't refer physically to water's edge. We're talking about anything anything controlled by the United States.
Essentially, yeah, that's correct. Right.
Okay. Thanks.
Go ahead, Mark.
Okay. So then we go to the basic formula and sort of the next layer of detail here. We start with U.S. federal consolidated taxable income. We multiply that by our apportionment factor, and I'll get to that in a minute, and to arrive at our Alaska taxable income. Our taxable income is multiplied by a tax rate, and the corporate rates graduate up to a maximum of 9.4% to arrive at the Alaska tax, and then, of course, we have some credits that we can apply. Let me talk a little bit about the apportionment factor. This is an average of three factors that are considered to be the activities that produce income. So we take Alaska property divided by U.S. property everywhere in the U.S. The same ratio, we take Alaska payroll divided by U.S. payroll. We take the sales the company makes in Alaska divided by the U.S. sales. We add those and divide by three to arrive at an average factor, and that's the percentage that we apply to their total income to attribute income to Alaska.
Mark, I have a question for you. Has that, in your opinion, has that benefited Alaska, not because we're getting more money, but has that benefited Alaska because we don't count some of the rest that we would have companies willing to come to Alaska? Has that helped any at all, do you think?
I really can't answer that question. I think
I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, we have to be careful with our tax structure so that we're not discouraging companies from coming to Alaska and doing business. And I was just wondering, is this the way most states do it, or is this totally different than what most states do? And is there an advantage for a company to come here because of it? That's my question.
Right. I understand. Most states use some kind of apportionment. Last count, I think it's something like 38 of the 50 states apportion income in some way or another. Some states use different formulas. This is the traditional formula that's been around for quite a while. Some states put more weight on the sales factor than on property and payroll. In my view, it's a fairly neutral formula. I am not aware that taxpayers have a problem with the formula itself.
Okay, thank you. Before we go any further, let the record show that Representative Grunberger has joined us. Okay, Mark, go ahead.
Okay. That's the basics of the mechanics of the tax. Dan suggested we also kind of cover a status report of where we are with the tax program.
Representative Seaton has a question.
Sure.
And in the non-oil corporate tax, what exclusions do we have that from that tax?
Exclusions as far as non-taxable entities, you mean?
Yes. I guess the one that I'm kind of familiar with is that, you know, we won the lawsuit, and I think it was 1989 on taxing of cruise ships.
Right. Okay. Right. I'm with you.
Corporate tax, and then that was excluded.
Right. We follow the Internal Revenue Code generally. So that means, for example, nonprofit corporations are exempt. And charitable organizations, that sort of thing. And as you mentioned, one of the big industries that are currently exempt by our own statute are the cruise ships, cruise ship industry, any company that's involved in air transportation or cargo transportation.
And if I might just interject for a moment, just to make it very clear.
Dan, say your name.
Yeah, Dan Dickinson. It's not that the cruise ship industry is exempt, it's that foreign flag carriers. So there are American cruise ships, and they would not be, their corporations would not be exempt. But if it's a foreign flag, then it's exempt. And of course, most of them that we deal with are.
Okay.
Right. As would be foreign air carriers and foreign transportation companies.
So a clarification on that, Madam Chair. So if we have a U.S. Airlines flying in, carrying freight through Anchorage or Fairbanks on international trips, they're subject to the corporate tax. But if we have a foreign airline flying those same routes, then they are not subject to a corporate tax?
That's correct. Right. And that's a function of the way the Internal Revenue Code section is arranged. Essentially, it's a function of treaty, where the federal government has basically made an arrangement with foreign governments that says if you don't tax our companies, we won't tax yours. So that each country taxes its own transportation company.
That was Representative Seaton that asked that question for the transport.
And I guess the other group, the large group of corporations that are not subject to this tax are S corporations. And those are the comes from the Internal Revenue Code subchapter S, where they are treated as they are taxed as partnerships, and the corporate income is passed through to the individual shareholders. Alaska statutes adopt that part of the Internal Revenue Code, and we don't tax the S corps.
Okay, Representative Grunberg, you had a question?
Yes, thank you. Back to the cruise ships. Can you give us a comprehensive statement, either now or in writing through the chair, of every type of fee and revenue-raising measure that has been upheld against the cruise ship industry anywhere in the country? Landing fees, anything?
I could try.
Thank you. I'm interested in those that have been upheld, and I'm actually also interested in those that have been struck down and the court's reasoning in each case. And I don't care whether it's called a tax, a fee, a charge, anything. Or can you tell us what kind of things have any of you, through the chair, that have been upheld? Landing fees, anything?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I think when we talk about tourism taxes later, I think that's going to be covered.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Maybe not quite in the comprehensive fashion that you had envisioned, but let's see if that can answer any of your questions.
At least we'll get the nose under the tent, huh?
Okay. That was Dan Dickerson that was speaking. Go ahead, Mark. You've got more for us, I assume?
Oh, yeah. I'm almost finished. The status report on where we are with the program currently, non-oil and gas corporations are our second priority, of course, to oil and gas. The oil and gas corporations by far pay the most tax, and that is where the highest level of audit risk is. We have limited audit resources available to devote to this group of taxpayers. Our current effort is to focus on known problems. We're involved in looking closely at the IRS tax shelter information. We have an exchange of information agreement with the Internal Revenue Service where we can gather information that they have at the federal level. And we're also trying to focus on single issue, what the jargon for us is it's called slam dunk issues that are fairly straightforward and where there's not a high likelihood of getting engaged in complicated appeals. For example, we are looking right now at the inclusion of what we call tax haven corporations. Our statute allows us to include corporations that are set up in tax haven countries. Those under our statute are included in the Water's Edge group. And we're looking to make sure those are included. That's a typical strategy for a multinational corporation to sort of hide income, is to attribute income to a subsidiary in, say, the Bermudas, Cayman Islands, that sort of thing.
Representative Seaton has a question.
Sure.
There was some indication that the administration might be coming forward with a proposal on S corporations. Is that still in the works?
Representative, this is Dan Dickinson. Through the chair, if I may answer that. We've been asked to analyze a number of issues. That's certainly one of them. We've developed some ideas, but right at the moment, I don't think it's clear which of those ideas, if any, we're going to the administration is prepared to bring forward.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead, Mark.
Sure. The long-term plan also is we need to start rebuilding our auditor ranks. Right now we're down to four auditors besides myself, in addition to myself. I think our budget requests some new positions, and we need to develop, we're in the process now of developing a training program for that. And we're also in the process of considering and developing a professional contract to help us focus better on our Water's Edge audit procedures, since they have not been our top priority for quite a few years now. We would really like someone to give us a sort of a peer review, professional review of our procedures in that area. And I'm finished with my part. If there are any other questions, I'd be glad to.
Representative Grunberg has a question for you.
Could you or somebody else provide this committee, for those of us who are not on the Department of Revenue subcommittee, with your request for increased funding for the audit division, peer review, anything else that you've just talked about?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, we certainly can do that. We'll be pleased
Thank
to
you.
Do that. And talk about it, too, if you'd like.
I'd like to read it first, and then I'll probably ask questions if I don't understand what I'm reading.
Fair enough.
Through the chair. Thank you.
Okay. Dan, you want to proceed?
Thank you, Mark. If there's no other questions, that's great. What I'd like to do next is move on. Joanna Bales is also in Anchorage, and she is next, and she is going to discuss the excise taxes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As Dan said, my name is Joanna Bales, and I'm the audit manager four or five of the excise tax types that the department administers. The one that isn't managed by my group is the mining license tax, and I will not be talking about that. I believe Brett Freed will be discussing that. And hopefully in front of you, you have an overview of the excise tax programs.
Yes, we do.
I'd like to just go quickly through this overview just to give you a general idea of the tax types that we do administer. The first is the motor fuel tax levied on all motor fuel that's sold, transferred, or used in Alaska. And our taxpayers are primarily distributors. The first person that brings motor fuel into the state for sale. And if you take a look across, we have approximately 255 taxpayers that file monthly returns, and several of those taxpayers file up to four monthly returns. So we do have quite a few tax returns that we deal with in this area. And if you look at the tax rates, the motor fuel tax is 8 cents a gallon for highway use, 5 cents a gallon for marine use, 4.7 cents per gallon for aviation gasoline, and 3.2 cents per gallon for jet fuel. There is another area that I actually left off of this, and I apologize. We also levy a tax of 2 cents per gallon for off-highway use. And basically the way that works is that if you purchase fuel for use, let's say, in a snow machine or a four-wheeler, you can claim a credit of 6 cents for the 8 cents that you paid and in essence pay 2 cents per gallon for the use of that fuel. And if you go across, the next is the revenue that we received for the motor fuel program in 2004, approximately $41.3 million, and we project around $39.5 million for the next 2 years.
Joanna, did you say for jet fuel it was 3.2 cents a gallon?
Yes, Madam Chair, I did.
Okay. I think on this sheet it's different. Oh, no, I guess maybe that is right. Yeah, that's right. Okay, thank you.
No problem. So if there are any questions, that's just a quick overview of the motor fuel program.
Representative Grunberg, he has a question.
Thank you. Ms. Bales, through the chair, why is your projected revenue going down for FY05 and 06?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, that's an excellent question, and those numbers come from our revenue sources book that was prepared by our economist, and hopefully, you know, can hold that question until Brett Freed is testifying. He can possibly tell you why, but I believe that might have something to do with the off-highway use refund claims that we get from some of our larger business entities that use fuel for off-highway use. But I would like for him to probably answer that question.
He's here, ready, willing, and able.
Okay, great.
Brett, go ahead.
Okay. I was just going to say, for the record, my name's Brett Freed. And the reason, it's not that it's trending down. It's that we had, in FY04, we had a large assessment that was, you know, larger than we normally have in terms of assessments. So the trend that I'm projecting out here is actually a level trend.
May I ask one question?
Representative Grunberg.
What kind of was this an unusual assessment? Is there a reason that
It just had to do with a single taxpayer.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When was the tax last increased on motor fuels?
Joanna, correct me if I'm wrong, but was it 1983 or?
I'm taking a look at the annual report. It does state in there the last time that was increased, and that would be that's on page 41 of the annual report. Back in 1994, it appears, was the last increase for jet fuel and aviation gasoline. But highway fuel, the last increase was in 1970. And the marine highway, the marine fuel, the last increase was in 1977.
Let the record show, while we have this little lull, that Representative Samuels has joined us. Thank you. Welcome. If there's no more questions, Joanna, go ahead.
Okay, so the next tax type that I'd like to discuss is the tire fee. And the tire fee is one of the new tax types that we've had. The effective date for that was September 26, 2003. The tire fee is assessed on all new tires sold in the state that are used on the highway, basically. So if you buy a tire for your lawnmower or your four-wheeler, there is not a tire fee assessed, but any tire sold for use on a motor vehicle, the fee is $2.50 per tire. Then effective July 1st of 2004, an additional fee on studded tires became effective. And basically, the way that works is that you pay the $2.50 for a new tire that's sold, but if there are heavy studs, which those are studs that weigh more than 1.1 grams, that you incur an additional fee of $5 per tire. So you can incur as much as $7.50 per tire when you purchase a new studded tire. In addition, the $5 fee applies to stud installation services as well. So if you take a used tire down to a dealership and ask them to put heavy studs in that, you are required to pay the $5 stud tire fee at that time as well.
Joanne, I have a question here. This is Wilson, Chair. I don't know anything about the weight of studs. So tell me, does that make a difference between big tires that would be on trucks versus on smaller trucks, or what does that differentiation in weight? What does that equate to in reality here?
Yes, Madam Chair. I mean, that's an excellent question, and I've learned more about studs than I ever thought was possible. Basically, most of, if not all of the aluminum studs that are used in tires in Alaska weigh less than 1.1 grams or no more than 1.1 grams, regardless of how large the tire is. They do have some fairly large aluminum studs that will exceed the 1.1 grams, but it's our understanding that those actually are not used in Alaska. All of the steel studs, however, regardless of the size of the tire, do weigh more than 1.1 grams. And it's our understanding, after actually going back to previous committee hearings, is that the intent of this law was to try to get people to use the aluminum studs, which are determined to be basically road-friendly. They don't cause the same type of wear and tear on the roads that the steel studs do.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So as you can see, we have approximately 131 taxpayers. This is a quarterly tax return filing requirement. And in FY 2004, the tire fee generated approximately $126,000, and the expectation is that it will generate approximately $2.6 million. And the reason for the increase is the fact that the studded tire fee was not in effect at all in 2004, in fiscal year 2004. So are there any questions then on the tire fee before I move on?
Doesn't look like it.
Okay, thank you. The next is our second newest excise tax type, which is the vehicle rental tax. And that tax became effective January 1st, 2004. The vehicle rental tax is assessed at the rate of 10% on the rental of passenger vehicles and 3% on the rental of recreational vehicles. If you rent a recreational vehicle or a passenger vehicle for more than 90 days, there is no vehicle rental tax assessed at that time. And we have approximately 122 taxpayers, and the vehicle rental tax, like the tire fee, is a quarterly tax return filing. And in fiscal year 2004, which was 6 months of filings, we generated approximately $2.7 million in revenue from this tax, and the expectation is that the revenue will be approximately $6.7 million per year going forward. Does anyone have any questions on the vehicle rental tax? I know I'm going through these fairly quickly.
No, they don't, so you can go to tobacco.
Okay, well, all right. And then our ever-favorite tobacco tax. This is probably one of the most complex tax types that we administer. And basically, Alaska levies a tax on cigarettes that are imported into the state for sale or personal consumption. The cigarette tax was 5 cents per cigarette or a dollar per pack through tax periods ending December 31st, 2004. Effective January 1st, 2005, as Dan pointed out, there was legislation this summer that increased the cigarette tax. So effective January 1st, 2005, through June 30th of 2006, the tax rate is 8 cents per cigarette or $1.60 per pack of 20. Then on July 1st of 2006, there will be an increase of 1 cent per cigarette, so the tax rate will be 9 cents per cigarette or $1.80 per pack. And then we have one other increase, which is effective July 1st, 2007. The tax rate will be 10 cents per cigarette or $2 per pack. One thing I, you know, didn't put on here, but in addition to this tax, Senate Bill 1001, which was passed during the special session this summer, also imposes an additional tax of 25 cents per pack on those cigarettes that were manufactured by what we call a non-participating manufacturer. And those are manufacturers that did not sign the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement. So in addition to these taxes, when the full graduated tax becomes effective beginning in July 2007, the tax for non-participating manufacturer product will be $2.25 a pack. Then we also levy a tobacco products tax, and this is a tax on everything other than a cigarette. So it's cigars, chewing tobacco, roll your own tobacco, those types of products. The other tobacco products is levied on other tobacco products imported into the state for sale. So there is a difference in the way that tax is levied as compared to the cigarette tax. If you import other tobacco products for personal consumption, there is no tax.
Joanna, I have a question going back. What companies didn't agree to on the settlement?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's another excellent question. That's there are, amazingly enough, thousands of cigarette manufacturers, and we've seen several that have actually began producing cigarettes since the Master Settlement Agreement was signed. But basically, if you look at just numbers, the majority of cigarette manufacturers across the world did not sign the Master Settlement Agreement. Those who did are companies like Philip Morris, R.J. Reynolds, Lorillard Tobacco, Liggett, Brown & Williamson. Those are the large, familiar tobacco manufacturers. Then we have a whole handful of other smaller tobacco companies that most people have never heard of. There's Kingmaker Marketing, BCT Tobacco, which is a foreign, I believe that product is manufactured in Indonesia. It kind of runs the gamut, but if you look at just in real numbers across the world, because this does apply to any cigarette imported into the country, whether I mean, used in the country, whether it's imported or manufactured here. So we do have quite a few non-participating manufacturers.
Is that very significant, the amount?
Well, I, Madam Chair, I'd have to say, let me kind of correct that. There are, across the world, quite a few non-participating manufacturers. And several of those do, I mean, quite a few of those do sell cigarettes in the country. However, in Alaska, it is a very non-participating manufacturer. Product is very, very small. It's less than 1%. It's about 0.4% of the total cigarettes that are consumed in Alaska.
Thank you. Representative Gruenberg has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Bales, with respect to this particular industry as an example, how are you able, as a practical matter, to collect taxes from those products that are sold on the Internet?
Yes, Representative Gruenberg, through the chair. That is difficult. However, we do have some tools out there. There is a federal law, it's called the Jenkins Act, that requires that anyone who sells cigarettes in interstate commerce is required to notify the tax administrator in the state where the cigarettes were sold, who purchased those cigarettes, how many cigarettes were purchased, and the date the cigarettes were purchased. That allows us to then go out and try to collect the tax from the individual who imported the product into the state. Unfortunately, we do not get very many companies that voluntarily comply with that federal law. When I first started working in this program, we had virtually no compliance with the Jenkins Act and virtually no enforcement by the federal government. However, within the past couple of years, there has been more enforcement by the federal government. They do provide information to each state after they've concluded an investigation or a case. And in fact, I received information about Internet sales made into Alaska in December of this year, which happened because of a federal case. So we are seeing that area kind of breaking open more. The National Association of Attorneys General is now working on trying to get credit card companies to provide information about sales that have been made when their credit cards were used. And it is a difficult area, and we are looking for ways to deal with it.
Thank you.
Well, I think that's no more questions, Joanne, so go ahead.
All right. So if you take a look, the actual revenue in fiscal year 2004 for cigarette and tobacco products tax was approximately $48.8 million. We expect that to increase in fiscal year 2005 to $51.8 million, and then again in fiscal year 2006 to $64 million. And the reason for that, obviously, is the cigarette tax rate increases. So if there are no more questions on tobacco, I will move down to the alcoholic beverage.
Go ahead.
Okay. So the alcoholic beverage tax is levied on the first sale of alcoholic beverages made in Alaska. And the tax rate on alcoholic beverages on liquor, which is alcohol with an alcoholic content of greater than 21% by volume, the tax rate is $12.80 a gallon. For wine and other beverages with an alcoholic content of 21% or less by volume, the tax rate is $2.50 a gallon. For malt beverages, beer, and hard cider, the tax rate is $1.07 a gallon. And for small breweries, the tax rate is $0.35 a gallon. And a small brewery, basically, back in 2002, when the alcoholic beverage tax rate was increased, a new provision, or I should say class of alcoholic beverage, was introduced as part of that legislation. And basically what we did at that time was piggybacked federal law. So under federal law, if you produce no more than 2 million barrels of beer a year, which is 62 million gallons, then you qualify as a small brewery. And then the first 60,000 barrels, or 1.8 million gallons, of the product that you sell qualifies for the reduced rate of tax. So we piggyback the federal law, and that is what qualifies as a small brewery.
Joanne, how many small breweries exceed that amount so that they pay a tax?
None.
Okay. Thank you.
So as you can see, the revenue that we generated in fiscal year 2004 was approximately $32.7 million. Projected revenues are approximately $31.8 million going forward.
Representative Seaton has a question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, do we have a do we have an estimate on what that tax is per serving, per type of alcohol?
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. The way the tax works and the way the increase happened, it's the tax comes down to 10 cents per drink. And a drink is defined for wine, it's 5 ounces per drink. For beer, it's 12 ounces per drink. And for the liquor category, it's 1 ounce per drink. And it is 10 cents per drink.
Thank you very much.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Bales, why is the revenue slightly going down?
Joanna, I could respond to that if you'd like.
That would be great, Brett, if you would.
this is Brett Freed, through the chair, Representative Grunberg. In this case, we changed the way has to do with accounting. We changed the way we did the accrual. We essentially added 15 more days on to the accrual, so that accounts for the difference between FY04 and FY05.
Thank you.
And we did that to accommodate the quarterly taxes.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have an example of the small brewery, a brand name? I mean, 16,
Representative Samuels, through the chair. Unfortunately, because of confidentiality, we are unable to provide that information.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Madam Chair, through the chair, we don't have any large breweries in Alaska, is that correct?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, yes, that is correct. We do not have any large breweries in Alaska. And actually, if you go back and look at the committee hearing, the minutes from the prior tax increase, the small brewery exemption was pushed by the Alaskan Brewing Company.
Thank you.
Okay.
I do have another question, but not on alcohol tax. Are any of these taxes, these excise taxes, exclusive, or can they also be applied at the local level as well?
Was that Representative Seaton?
Yes, it was.
Yes. On alcoholic beverages, there is a state statute that says that the only taxes that can be leveled by local, by communities, municipalities, those type of thing, is a property tax on alcoholic beverage inventories and a sales tax. But you can only levy a sales tax on alcoholic beverages if you levy a sales tax on some other commodity. So you don't necessarily have to have a citywide sales tax, but you would have to have a sales tax on something else. For instance, if you had a vehicle rental tax or a bed tax, you could then have a sales tax on alcoholic beverages. But communities are prohibited from levying their own excise tax on alcoholic beverages. As far as the other tax types, there is no prohibition that I'm aware of.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, if I might follow up, and Joanna, please correct me if I'm wrong. It's my belief that Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Yakutat have a vehicle rental tax. Fairbanks and Anchorage have tobacco taxes, but I'm not aware that any other municipalities have tire fee or motor fuel taxes.
And that was Dan Dickinson?
Excuse me.
Representative Seaton.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up. So motor fuel tax is not a state category as well. Individual communities can also have a motor fuel tax.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, and Joanna, please again correct me if I'm wrong. I do not believe it is specifically excluded, and in fact, if a community has a general sales tax, typically that would be included.
Yes, I believe, Dan, that that's correct. There's nothing that I'm aware of that prohibits them from assessing their own motor fuel tax.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Joanna. Did you have anything else for us?
No, I'm finished.
Thank you very much. Representative Gruenberg has a question.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does any jurisdiction, and this is a general question to anybody here, there, anywhere, exercise an excise tax on internet sales?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, one of the problems that we have with, we do have an excise tax on internet sales, but that's by virtue of the fact that the product has been imported and the tax is levied against the person who imports the product. And if I'm understanding, I think probably the gist of your question is whether or not we can tax the internet seller. Is that correct?
Well, I wasn't being that specific.
Okay.
It's more the transaction I'm interested in. And who pays it? I suppose it would ultimately come down to the purchaser anyway.
Yes, that would be correct. So the first person who imports, whether you carry the product in or purchase it over the internet or have Aunt May in Nebraska ship it to you, you are responsible to pay the cigarette tax because that is the way that tax statute is written. So anytime we have a tax where it's a tax on importation, the person who imports the product would be responsible for the tax, regardless of how they purchased it. I mean, for example, on the alcoholic beverage tax, you can go on the internet and purchase, I mean, they have beer and wine clubs, and you can import beer and wine into Alaska. However, Alaska's law says that the tax is only levied on alcoholic beverages that are sold in the state. So if you import for personal consumption, you do not pay the alcoholic beverage excise tax.
What I was getting at through the chair, maybe this isn't the right place, but if you buy whatever it is, I'm not talking specifically about these products, I'm talking about pretty much anything, and you buy it over the internet, we don't have a statewide sales tax. But the most municipalities do. It's my understanding that their taxing doesn't reach sales over the internet. So if you buy stuff over the internet, no matter where you live, whatever you buy, let's exclude the stuff that's on here, that comes in tax-free. Am I right?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, it depends upon how the tax structure, how the tax law, for instance, the sales tax is written. Is it written as a sales and use tax? I mean, a sales tax is when a sale is made in your community and the tax is levied. A use tax would be on product if you purchased it over the internet or mail order, that type of thing. If the municipal code or state law said included a use tax as a sales tax, then yes, you as an individual would be required to pay the use tax on that product that you imported.
And, Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, if I might add to that, in fact, Juneau, for example, would be an exception that does focus on, that does has a use tax. Many of the communities that have sales taxes do not, in fact, have use tax provisions associated with it, and they don't have the kind of, as you might suggest, imagine, the kind of enforcement mechanisms or the people devoted to use tax enforcement.
Thank you.
For the record, that was Dan Dickinson.
Madam Chair, if I may just...
Representative...
So what we, if we wanted to get at those or a locality did, it wouldn't be a sales tax technically, it'd be a use tax.
Yes, that's correct, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Joanne. And I guess next we have Tim Cottingham with the fisheries tax.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Tim Cottingham, and I'm the manager for the new fish group. We're responsible for five, as of today, fish taxes that we oversee and collect in revenue. I'm going to start. I've given a handout that hopefully all of you have. I'll start with the fisheries business tax, which is our biggest tax in the fisheries area. For FY04, the collections were $29.2 million. 14.3 of that was shared back to local municipalities, and the state's amount was 14.84. There were 525 taxpayers. This tax is imposed upon processors in-state as well as exporters of unprocessed product out of the state. It's based upon the value of the product, raw. Some in the industry still refer to this as the raw fish tax, which is what it used to be called many years ago. There are essentially three different tax rates imposed. The highest rates imposed upon floating processors of 5%, salmon canneries are taxed at 4.5%, and shore-based processors 3%. That's assuming that the product is an established species. For those that are processing or exporting developing species, the rate is reduced by 2%.
Representative Seaton.
Can you give us examples of what you're classifying as developing?
Developing is normally the species, first of all, it's a designation that's made by the Department of Fish and Game every year. Normally it's going to be a species that is underfished, that there's the desire to encourage additional fishing. It may also be tied to a fishery that is not necessarily developing except for where it's located. I think, for instance, there are some halibut that are considered developing species around the St. Paul, one of the other Adak Island area, or one of the Aleutian Island areas that's not normally fished. I think they created that list for that particular species as developing because they wanted to encourage the local fishermen to fish that particular species.
Go ahead.
Just to follow, and that list is submitted to you by Fish and Game?
Correct.
Okay, and so that's probably on their internet
website. It is. It's attached to our tax return form, so you'll find it when you download the return form.
Thank you.
I have a question. This is Wilson, Chair. What about the aquatic fisheries? Is that, are they considered new and developing yet, or are they taxed at a...
Some of them are. There are a few that aren't. I couldn't tell you without actually pulling the list and telling you which. The list is voluminous.
Okay.
So some are and some aren't.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Seaton.
Madam Chair, I missed your question. What was it?
Oh, I wanted to know if any of the aquatic ones, like the gooey ducks and clams and all that, if they were, which category they were in.
Right. I think that maybe we should clarify that those that are farmed, that this is a wild resource tax, and so that the stuff from the farm does not fall under this, I believe, if the department wants to clarify.
Okay. Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. Representative Seaton. That's true. It's not considered, quote-unquote, wild. However, this tax is an occupation tax, and it's on the occupation of processing or exporting. So whether it's farmed product or even brought in from Canada, if it's first processed here, is subject to this tax.
Thank you. Go ahead.
The next largest tax types that we administer is the resource landing tax. We collected $6.86 million in fiscal year 04. shared $4.36 million with local municipalities, retained $2.5 million. There are approximately 42 taxpayers in fiscal year 04. This particular tax is imposed on at-sea processors that are processing outside the three-mile limit and first land the fish in the state of Alaska. It's based upon the statewide average price, which is a list that Fish and Game puts together each year from the commercial operator's annual report and provides to us. Each of the landing taxpayers are required to pay quarterly estimated tax each year as well. The rate for the landing tax is a static 3%. Again, for developing species, it's reduced by 2%.
Representative Seaton.
I wanted to go back to the fisheries business tax for just a moment. The so the farms that are operating oysters, for instance, we're charging the fisheries business tax on those farm products that's exported from the state unprocessed.
Correct.
Is that okay? That's different information we had last year. And Madam Chair, I'd like to follow up. You have the amount that is shared back with local municipalities. Can you go run through that with us?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Some of that information can be found on table two on page 14 of the division's annual report. We also put out a shared taxes report, which can be downloaded and we can make available to you. There's specific breakdown of the sharing for, you were referring to fisheries tax, Representative Seaton?
Yes.
This particular report, and I'm looking at this point at table five of the shared report, breaks it down by municipality, by amount.
What page
was
that?
Folks don't have the shared reports.
Oh, okay.
Need it.
Okay, I was going to say I can't find it. Okay, proceed.
So we can make that available to you, Representative Seaton.
Okay, I can get that explanation later.
Okay.
That'd be
fine.
Okay. If there are no other further questions, I'll move on to the seafood marketing assessment tax. This is a tax that, in essence, comes with both the fisheries business and the resource landing tax return. It is imposed in the same manner. The only exception is that there must be a value of $50,000 or greater for this tax to kick in. Again, it's similar to the fisheries business. For those fisheries business taxpayers, it's imposed on all fish that they process in the state or export unprocessed from the state. For landing taxpayers, it's any fish that are first processed at sea and first landed in the state. Proceeds from this particular tax help to fund the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, or ASME as we refer to it, and the tax rate is 0.5%. That rate took effect January 1st. The previous rate was 0.3%. And in conjunction with the increase to this tax, the industry elected to eliminate what was previously called the salmon marketing tax. And so you don't see that here because the salmon marketing tax is no longer there.
Representative Seaton.
And the same question as before, is this tax levied on mariculture farm product that is exported?
Yes, it is. The next tax type is a salmon enhancement tax. We collected $3.3 million. This is a tax that's paid by the fishermen on all salmon sold in or exported from an established aquaculture region. Got a list of the aquaculture regions and the applicable rate that the associations have agreed to impose upon themselves. Proceeds from this tax are appropriated back to the respective aquaculture regions. This helps subsidize, for example, the hatcheries in the particular regions. It is not in and of itself sufficient to fund the hatcheries. It just simply subsidizes it. And by the way, that tax is more like a sales tax. It does not matter whether or not the product is processed or unprocessed. It's simply a matter of whether or not it was caught inside the region or sold inside the region. And then lastly, the dive fishery management assessment tax. It's similar to the salmon enhancement tax in that it's self-imposed. The Southeast Dive Fishery Development Association has elected to establish a region where they self-impose this tax. It's a quarterly tax. There are only at present three fishery that are included in this tax: the geoduck, sea cucumber, and sea urchin. The rates are listed. The geoduck was recently increased. It was 5% effective October 1st. The organizations elected to increase the tax to 7%. And again, like the salmon enhancement tax, this tax, in essence, is appropriated back to this region to subsidize the association.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How about, like, for people who harvest, isn't there a seaweed tax?
Seaweed?
I mean seaweed industry, that sort of thing?
We don't tax any, at present, to my knowledge, we don't tax plant sea life at this point.
Is there such an industry in the state?
I don't know. I can find out.
That's all right.
Representative Samuels?
Thank you, Commissioner. What about like herring roe that's on the kelp?
Yeah, that's kind of stuff.
Herring roe for sure. Is subject to tax, correct?
That's what I guess I was thinking.
Representative Seaton?
On the salmon enhancement tax, it's, it says salmon sold in or exported from an established agriculture region. There's a lot of caught in one area and sold in another. Does this come off the fish ticket where it was caught or where it sold, or let's say Fisher caught in Kodiak and delivered in Homer? Where does the tax
go? Right. If Representative Seaton, if both of the locations, both where it was caught and where it was sold, were our established aquaculture regions where they have agreed to assess a tax, then the tax return allows them to report both where caught as well as where sold. And generally, unless there's a huge discrepancy, we will apply it to the place where sold. The legislature has the authority in the appropriation to compare those figures. I believe the Department of Administration prepares those figures, and you have the authority, I think, to decide if there is a huge discrepancy, to instead of sharing it where we normally share it, which would be the place where sold, to the place where caught.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do you have anything else for us?
And actually, if I could ask Madam Chairman, Dan Dickinson, this is just an interesting detail to me, if you think about what a tax division normally does, and to me, if you could just very briefly share sort of the role that tax division plays in one of these elections when folks take the self-assessment and change that or have an election to see if they're going to change the self-assessment.
Madam Chair, assuming that we are given a heads up on the elections, because sometimes we aren't always, as far as our process goes, and I'm relatively new, so I'm not going to be able to give you all of the details, but we're usually working closely with the organization to understand how they're going to self-impose the tax, because we need to obviously design our tax returns and have them ready and available as soon as they're ready to begin to collect the tax. So that's the major responsibility for us. In addition, we probably will have to work with Fish and Game and others to ensure that we have the proper method to, you know, verify reportings. I guess there's a whole gamut of things that we would have to do whenever a new election is imposed. Mapping is another area where we would need to ensure that we can define the borders for the particular region to ensure, like we have discovered over the years, that Yakutat, for example, falls outside of some of these regions, and a lot of folks didn't know that until we started looking closely at the maps and realized, you know, that they weren't a part of any aquaculture region. So that's just one of many things that we have to do when these elections occur.
This is the chair. How do you police some of this so that you know people are, you know, is there ways that you follow up and check things out?
That's a good question. We have the ability, and luckily we have a good relationship with the Department of Fish and Game, that they're willing to share basic fish ticket information with us so that we can track in the event that folks don't show up. And normally salmon is going to be showing up on a fisheries business tax return. And we will compare information on tax return, fisheries business tax returns with salmon enhancement tax returns. And that's one compliance tool. The other is, of course, fish tickets. And then the third is the industry itself. We've hopefully developed a better relationship with industry so that they understand that the more information that they give us to ensure that the proper taxes are collected so that it's done fairly and everyone is treated fairly, the better off everyone is.
Representative
Seaton. So if we were looking at salmon that are caught in southeast Alaska and then are transported to Prince Rupert for processing, how does that flow these different taxes? How are those apportioned and also shared back to communities or aquaculture associations?
Okay, good question. Because they were caught in southeast, depending on whether it's northern or southern southeast, and then exported from, they would be subject to the salmon enhancement tax. In this case, depending upon who exported, if it was the fisherman would report directly to us the salmon enhancement tax on that region where he caught it and exported it from. Fisheries business tax, same thing. They would report it because they exported, assuming it's unprocessed, out of the state. They would also report that. As far as the sharing would go, it falls into that category where it, in essence, wasn't subject to tax within an organized borough at that point because of the exporting. And so as far as the fisheries business tax shares goes, that goes into that pool that DCED allocates out to the various communities throughout the state based upon whatever formula that they use.
And follow up, and if that fish is landed in that in a community, is in a borough, is in a municipality, and is exported to Prince Rupert unprocessed, what's that do for this?
Again, I think what we focus on is where it was taxable, and in this case, since it wasn't processed in the community, it was merely landed there and I assume transshipped. Arguably, if it was on an airplane, for example, or even a truck, you could argue, I suppose, that it probably should be cited back to that community. But technically, when it crosses the border is when it's subject to tax. And technically, that's where we would look to see where, you know, we would share the proceeds back.
So the fish that are caught, say, in Ketchikan, go in through their port, transship, whatever, and leave on a tender down, then that tax comes in and goes to Department of Commerce, which doesn't share that necessarily back to that doesn't come back to that community because it went through a border crossing, so it goes broadly across the state.
That's a good question, Representative Seaton. Madam Chair, I should say that a lot of this sharing information is voluntarily provided, and we aren't necessarily going out and checking to make sure that we should have recorded it as right before it crossed the border. Most of the companies that would be reporting on a fisheries business tax return would probably indicate the location having been Ketchikan, in which case we would honor that, and that's where we would share it back to.
I have a question then for that. If they didn't say Ketchikan, and you had to just decide where that income goes or that tax for the sharing for the municipalities, if I understand it right, you try to do it by region, or is it statewide?
It's my understanding it's statewide. It's Department of Community Economic Development that is responsible for allocating that. They have a formula which I'm not entirely comfortable explaining to you. They'd be better, I think, suited to explain it to you unless someone here could explain it with me. But they have some sort of an allocation process, and I honestly don't know whether or not they limit it to only those areas of the state where there actually is some processing going on.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Yeah, Madam Chair, maybe we can get some further detail on that, because my understanding is, I mean, we have this in Homer where fish are landed in Homer, are boxed, iced, et cetera, in Homer, and then are trucked out, and it doesn't matter whether they are said that they're processed by DC standards in Homer or not, that the Department of Revenue allocates that as not to the community, so that the revenue isn't shared back through there, but it goes through DCED. So if we could get a, that's my understanding.
Yeah, I think Chuck Harlemer, Madam Chair, may be able to answer that question.
Chuck?
Sure, my name is Chuck Harlemer. I'm with the Tax Division, Department of Revenue. Any product that is exported unprocessed, the taxpayers are expected to report it on a schedule for unprocessed product that is exported. And all tax associated with that fish is split between the general fund and DCED. And DCED distributes that to communities across the state. Their formula is very much based upon the volume of processed product in regions across the state. So in the case of Homer, for example, fish that comes across the dock and is trucked out of state without being processed, half the tax on that fish would end up going to DCED and be distributed to communities across the state based upon the volume of processing in communities across the state. And Homer would get its relative share of that tax based on how much was actually processed in Homer. So obviously a port that is principally a just a waypoint for fresh fish going out of state is not going to see any appreciable amount of revenue. And the revenue associated with the fish that goes through there is basically going to land through DEC in places where processing occurs.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, Madam Chair, so talking like Homer or talking like Craig, where they have the dive fishery that ships out live product now instead of processing the gooey ducks down there, then that high-value fishery also gets distributed to the ports that do the highest volume of processing instead of the value of the processing. Is that correct?
Or? Through the Chair, Representative Seaton, that is correct. And I think the difference in the explanations you have here is that is based upon whether it's reported to us correctly. That is report to us correctly, that's exactly what happens. The Craig or Wrangell or wherever this live product was landed and shipped out isn't going to get credit for it directly, if at all.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Follow up.
And under the department's definition of processing, the troll caught fish. And the direct marketing bill that we passed to allow more marketing of troll-caught fish, those fish then will go through the same DCED, Commerce and their new name, Department of Commerce formula instead of through the community where the revenue activity takes place?
Through the Chair, Representative Seaton, a typical troll-caught fish that's just princess dressed, isn't frozen, headed, or filleted, is not considered processed under our revenue rules. And yeah, the exact same thing would happen if it got shipped out fresh, princess dressed. The tax associated with that fish wouldn't be attributed to the community for which it got shipped or was first landed.
Okay. Yeah, Madam Chair, yeah, and that's another issue that hopefully we'll be able to see here one of these days soon is trying to get that shared revenue back to the communities that generate the revenue. And though that's not your formula, we'll be talking with you later. So thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Tim. We appreciate it. And Dan, we'll...
Madam Chair, again, the next person who I'd like to speak... thanks, Tim, is Brett Freed, and he's going to talk about sort of the remaining taxes, some of which are not taxes, but, you know, maybe. One of the points I'd like to emphasize as you think about some of these taxes or potential taxes that he's talking about is a point that I've tried to have other folks make as they've made their presentations, which is we have a very small number of taxpayers for each tax type. Many of the ones that you've seen today have several hundred taxpayers. Some of our oil and gas taxes were down into the tens of taxpayers. So they really are a series of sort of boutique taxes, each aimed at a very small niche. And with that, I'll let Brett Fried talk about some additional taxes that are under consideration or ones we already have. Thank you, Brett.
I'm going to start with the mining license tax, and that's the only one that I'm going to discuss. That's a tax that we actually have. Sorry.
Which page are we on, Brett?
Oh, I didn't provide a handout, but if you look in the annual report, all the information I'm going to give is in the annual report. If you look on page 38 of the annual report.